So our next speaker needs no introduction, Dr. Bruce Ritchie. Bruce took a very successful hemophilia treatment center, similar to what was described by Kelsey, and expanded it to other disorders. So I'm going to ask Bruce to talk about how that happened. Here we go.
Thanks, David. This is our first meeting of the NRBDO back in 2004, and there's some interesting and slightly younger-looking people. David's there. David has darker hair than he does now. So does this guy here. That's me, Tom Bowen, who's always had white hair as long as I've known him. And I got to know him about 30 years ago. And some people who are absent, James Krepner was there. He unfortunately died a few years ago, and it was a huge loss to the country. He sat on the board of Canadian Blood Services. Anyway, how do I advance the slides? Is this so? Okay, there we go. So this is that. I have conflicts of interest. There's lots of our friends from pharma around today. I work quite closely with them because I'm not a surgeon. I can't fix things with catgut and steel. So I take part in clinical trials. I go to advisory boards. Stop that, Craig. But because I work with Alberta Health Services, Health Canada, CHS, Alberta's workers' compensation, just about every government organization I can, I choose not to take honoraria, but instead ask if there are any honoraria to have them made out to the University of Alberta. So this is what I intended to say a few days ago, but I'm not going to talk about all these things in the interest of time. But I did want to talk about some thoughts about the economics of healthcare and how technology and productivity are changing that, because as you all know, there's a huge, huge change happening in healthcare at the present time. New technologies are coming fast and furious. They're changing the whole way we do healthcare, and the impact is huge. The financial costs are high, but the benefits are also huge. So, is Hillary Longhurst here? I think she was invited, but she didn't make it. Ah, great, because I've stolen many of her slides. Anyway, Hillary Longhurst is an immunologist and angioedema treater in the UK, and has been instrumental in setting up comprehensive care programs in that area in the United Kingdom. And so this is one of her slides showing the costs of health care. One is absolute cost, the other is cost per capita over the last number of years. And you can see it's going straight up. And this is a big concern to government. And they're trying to figure out how to fix that. And I think the comprehensive care model is one of the answers to that. And so there's a great book that I found in an airport bookstore, which is where I seem to pick up all my books these days. It's called The Second Machine Age, and you can actually get this online. There's a draft available online, so if you don't want to pay for it, just download it. And it's very, very useful because it tells us a lot about where the world's been and where the world's going. And here's an example. This is a graph of human social development, which means access to democracy, rule of law, you know, having a police force you can count on and who isn't going to shoot you when you come and ask for their help, and all those sorts of things. And you can see it parallels the human population. And things went along very swimmingly, not much happening for thousands of years. That's the birth of Christ. And you can see there are little blips here and there. Some of that is around development of the wheel, I think. Actually, the wheel's way back here somewhere. But also an invention of written communications and all those sorts of things. But really not much happens until here. And it happens here because of the introduction of the Watt steam engine. And I think that's a proof of principle in that it was the first time that one person could do the work of many people. And with that, suddenly the world took off. So both social development and the population took off. And of course, we don't use steam engines anymore, but they've been replaced by electric motors, gas motors, robotics, you name it. And you all know where the world's going in that respect. And so you'd say, well, that's great. You know, there's many more of us and we're doing much better. But how do we pay for it all? Well, you know, obviously we have paid for it. When I was a young man in the 70s, I still remember I remember we were all told that we were going to run out of food in the next decade or so. So the population was growing so quickly and our food production was not growing that fast at all. So we were all going to be fighting each other and we should be stocking our bunkers now. And a lot of people believe that, but just look around. Food is cheaper than it's ever been in the history of the world, and it's more available. And despite what the press says, there's less poverty, there's more democracy, there's less malnutrition. The world's actually going in the right direction. And I think that's because of technology and other parts of social development. But one of the key economic arguments that's always made is that there's a fixed pie. This is a quote by Milton Friedman, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics. He said, most economic fallacies derive from the tendency to assume that there is a fixed pie that one can only gain at the expense of another. And that's just not true. Oops. And that's because of this. So this looks at productivity, labor productivity, between 1970, I finished high school in 72, and 2015. And this was happening during our lifetime. Productivity, we are being more productive per person across the world. And part of that's due to technology, part of that's due to organization and social organization and other things. But because of that, we're actually doing a better job at many things. So there isn't a fixed pie. But one of the things we must do is stop doing those things that don't work, instead do the things that do work. So our comprehensive care programs, which David just told me I should talk about, luckily it's in the slides. So David's right, and I said this last night at the CPO meeting. You know, I looked at this model we had of comprehensive care, and actually Kelsey comes from this little tiny province of Saskatchewan, which geographically is very big, and I go there all the time because I like those guys. But when I go to their comprehensive care clinic, I'm jealous because they have offices that I don't. They have more people per patient than I do. But we've made do and we've done pretty well. We have a comprehensive care program that does all the things that Kelsey's mentioned and has done it for all of the 26 years I've been in Edmonton. And a few years ago, back around 2000, I said, well, this is a great model. We should expand it. So instead of doing just hemophilia patients, we took on all bleeding disorder patients. And now we have the largest number of registered patients in the country, well over 1,000 as of about 3 years ago. And we rolled out that program to hereditary angioedema, immunodeficiency, hemoglobinopathy, porphyria, Ehlers-Danlos, and we're trying to get a Gaucher's clinic set up. And all of these are truly comprehensive care, and most of them provide home treatment. Hemoglobinopathy is mostly hospital-based, but all of them, where possible, provide home treatment. And you might notice all the staff that are listed here, and the physicians are listed last because, you know, they help to organize the whole thing, but at the end of the day, most of the work is done by the others. And the nurse and social worker are really, really key to everything we do, absolutely key. In hemophilia, we have physio and orthopedics. We have a dentist and a hematologist that comes to every comprehensive clinic. It really is amazing to see, you know, half a dozen patients in the rooms and the orthopedic surgeon, the physiotherapist, the dentist going around to see them all and then meeting for a conference afterwards. And we've rolled that out for all these other programs, and we now have, in addition to the largest bleeding disorder program in the country, Kelsey, take note, we have the largest HAE and home treatment programs for immunodeficiency in the Americas, in North, Central, and South America. And we have a, we went from having no hemoglobinopathy program about 10 years ago to having one where Richard Ward from Toronto likes to come out and say, well, how did you guys do that? In between telling us we're just from Edmonton, so. Anyway, so this is what the clinic's based on. This is the our policies. We have an annual visit. So if you're going to be on home treatment, you have to come in annually. And the patients don't always like to do this. One of our hemophilia patients, who has been a master at avoiding seeing us, actually went for a full decade without seeing a physician. And when I discovered this, I was amazed because I thought he died years earlier. And but my staff had been giving out blood products under my name for a decade without me even knowing about it. So I thought that was a big, big problem. So I instituted this policy that if you weren't seen every year, you were cut off. If you didn't provide log sheets of what you were using the products for, you were cut off. And the nurses, who are much more soft-hearted than I, would say, oh, we can't do that. And I said, well, maybe you can't, but you just tell the patients, I'm the bad cop. Dr. Ritchie says, no more products. And we've actually done this. And it's not like we're cutting off treatment. We're just telling the patients they can treat themselves in the emergency room. If they want to go to the emergency room and sit around waiting for 6 hours for a doctor who knows nothing about hemophilia to see them, well, good luck. So mostly they come and see us. And we actually have a selection of hematologists. So if they don't like me, which is fairly common these days, they can go and see one of the others. They must provide us with treatment logs. And as Kelsey mentioned, there's this Canadian Bleeding Disorder Registry, which I think is a great model for how things should be done. We've been using a program called CHARMS for the longest time. It's just not viable anymore because of the time needed for data entry. We have two full-time data entry people, and they still can't keep up because we've applied this program to immunodeficiency and angioedema and other things as well. But the CBDR is a electronic program, so the patients do all the data entry, well, 95% of the data entry, which has improved things dramatically. And testing. So patients on home immunoglobulin, they have to produce their immunoglobulin levels for us at least every 3 months because that's the longest we'll give them between distributing products. And we have support. And again, I'm jealous of Kelsey. Our support with nursing and social workers, 8 to 4. So when he says there's somebody on call, I'd like to talk to him about that because the only people on call at night in Edmonton are myself and my colleagues. But we do have 24/7 access with an on-call physician. We have emergency room protocols, which has helped a lot, and factor first cards, which are designed so that when a patient goes to emergency and provides this factor first card, they're supposed to get clotting factor before they get their CT scans and other things. It almost never happens. If you have hemophilia and you get in a car accident and you've had a facial smash and a neck injury and chest trauma, you always get your CT first before you get the blood products, which is just fundamentally wrong, and we're still working on that. But we use the same cards now for hemoglobinopathy, for sickle cell. We've got angioedema cards, and they really do make a big difference. And I tell the patients, when you go to the emergency room and you give the card to the staff and they say, oh, yeah, well, we're not going to call Dr. Ritchie because it's 2 or 3 in the morning, I say to the patients, well, if the doctor's not going to call us, then you call us. And they say, oh, well, I didn't want to bother you. And I say, well, if you waited in the waiting room for 8 hours, then that's your own fault because you have my number, you have the hospital number, your fingers aren't broken, so just call us. And so that's improving. And the critical thing is a family physician. A lot of the patients come in and they want me to refill their hypertensive medications and things like that. And, you know, I tell them I can't even spell half these new antihypertensive meds, and so I'm the wrong guy for that. But there's actually data on this. And this is a great study that was done by a colleague of mine in Edmonton, and again, to compare Alberta to Saskatchewan. This was funded by Alberta Health, but Alberta Health didn't want to give up any data, so they told the researchers, go to Saskatchewan, because they're much more free with the data. But basically what this shows is a survival curve, basically, and patients who are on primary care versus specialist care. And basically, the idea is that if you go to a specialist, you, and this is for diabetes, by the way, if you go to a specialist, your diabetes care is better, but your survival's not as good because the diabetologist doesn't look at your other things, doesn't measure your PSA and, you know, do the regular finger up the backside sort of thing and do an occasional chest x-ray, whereas the diabetologists, like us hematologists, are completely focused on their narrow area. So you do need a family doctor, and it actually provides a survival benefit. So here's some pharmacoeconomic data, and because I work in so many different areas, I'm going to jump back and forth, and I'm going to try and concentrate just on the pharmacoeconomic stuff. This is a paper by, thanks David, I got 5 minutes. This is a paper by Ann Gardolf, who really started the sub-Q IG programs in the world. She's from Sweden, and she looked in this paper from 1995 at patients with chronic variable immunodeficiency or X-linked agammaglobulinemia, and looked at treatment use at home and what the costs were for the patients, because in Sweden, all the costs of healthcare are borne by the government. And there was a big saving in the amount that was paid back in 1995. Of course, things have changed a lot in the last 20 years. And this is a wonderful paper written by Bob Schellenberg in Vancouver, looking at the resources needed for home treatment of immunodeficiency with subcutaneous immunoglobulin. And this just shows you the number of supplies and days of treatment. RN hours, manager hours, unit clerk hours, all those sorts of things. And when you translate them into costs, this is what the costs are. And we're going to just zip through quickly. And these are the overall savings by just switching patients from intravenous immunoglobulin in hospital to sub-Q IG at home. And you can see the cost savings are huge. And these are per patient cost. So, you know, total of $5,000 a year. That's a huge, huge cost savings. Not only that, but of course the patients would rather be treated at home. They'd rather be in control of their own destiny, all those sorts of things. This is a similar paper, and it comes from Ellie Haddad's group in Montreal. Ellie is a wonderful pediatric immunologist, and basically shows similar data. The nursing hours spent, technician hours, and things up here. And when you translate that into savings, there's huge, huge difference in costs, which is summed up here of $2,500 per patient. And this is yet a third paper of Canadian data. Some guy named Steve Betchel. Oh, there you are, Steve. Now, this is an important paper because it actually extrapolates what the costs would be across the country. Implications to payers of the switch from hospital-based IVIG to home-based sub-QIG. And I'm just going to go through the data. This is number of patients that's estimated in the country, and I've concentrated on Alberta and Ontario because I'm from Alberta and because I'm now in Ontario. This looks at nursing hours in year one. There's some training that needs to be done, and monitoring stays the same, but the nursing hours completely disappear for training. And the compensation, of course, goes way down with that. And when you actually start to convert that to dollars, it adds up. I'm just going to zip through these. So the next one is probably the more important one, which in Alberta is the labor costs alone, based on the number of patients that Steve calculated and the savings per patient, $3.88 million a year. And there's another place here, Ontario, oh yeah, and $13.5 million a year. And that's, of course, back in 2014, and the costs continue to go up, and labor costs are the lion's share of this. But the other thing, and I think it's important not to forget this, is capacity issues. So in our center, the emergency units are completely overwhelmed and overloaded. So we've been at greater than 100% capacity in the hospitals for all of the 26 years I've been in Edmonton. So what that means is there are more patients admitted at the hospital than there are beds. And that means they're on stretchers in the ambulance bays and places like that. And the acuity of the patients has continued to go up, and the number of patients in the stretchers has never gone down. So if you look at this as not a money thing, but as a capacity thing, how do we get people out of those emergency beds and emergency stretchers and out of hospitals? Just a simple little program like this saves huge hours of capacity. That should have been in your paper, but I did this graph just for today. And so I'm going to stop there and say, you know, what we're doing really is obvious, and it was obvious to me 20 years ago, it was obvious to the hemophilia folks 40 years ago, and we're still doing a lot of things that we shouldn't be doing. We should never give intravenous immunoglobulin in hospital. I direct the medical outpatient unit in Edmonton, and we're on a pilot study now to replace all the IVIG in hospital. In those patients who can't do things at home, we're going to replace it with hospital-based sub-Q IG because it's faster and we have less reactions. In our place, we've been getting one MET call, which means the ICU team gets called to our medical outpatient unit for IVIG reactions every month. And that's a huge drain on resources. And we could make that go away just by switching those patients from IVIG to sub-QIG. And we have now 300 patients on sub-QIG, all doing it at home. And those are 300 patients who would have been coming in every 3 to 4 weeks and spending 4 hours in the emergency or in the outpatient unit. And so you can do the sums. There's 1,200 hours or so of nursing time that's been taken out of our outpatient facilities, and that's allowed us to start doing outpatient chemotherapy and other things. So money's a big thing, capacity's the other big thing. Thanks very much.